Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. President Obama makes a move against solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. And today, a federal judge will hold a hearing on whether to grant a final approval of a case which will end indeterminate solitary confinement throughout California prisons. Our guest is Rachel Maripol, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Syrian peace talks have been delayed until Friday over disagreement over who represents the opposition at the talks to the Assad government. And breaking news, an IS bombing in the city of Homs in Syria have killed at least 20 people. For an update on Syria, on political alliances in the region, and the role of the U.S. in the Syrian conflict and in the region, we speak with Robert Parry, an award-winning investigative journalist and editor of ConsortiumNews.com. Also, an update on the Porter Ranch gas leak, referred to as the largest environmental disaster in the U.S. since the BP oil spill in 2010. We speak in studio with Alexandra Nagy, the Southern California organizer at the L.A. branch of Food and Water Watch, and our weekly Earth Minute. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The Mid-Atlantic region is working to return to normal after a crushing blizzard that left up to 3 feet of snow. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
This storm was the second largest snowstorm in terms of accumulation in the history of this city.
Schools and government offices are closed in Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. Schools and government offices are closed in Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. 88 million people across 24 states were affected. At least 29 people died, many from heart attacks after shoveling snow. North Carolina's new voter identification mandate, scheduled to start with the March primary, is on trial in federal court beginning today. The Federal Justice Department, state NAACP, League of Women Voters, and others contend the requirement to show photo ID to vote in person is illegal and will make it harder for Black and Latino residents of North Carolina to cast ballot. The state's lawyers say there's no evidence anyone will be denied the chance to vote under the rules. The trial could last up to a week. The United Nations Special Envoy on Syria says he hopes to start peace talks between the government and opposition groups on Friday. Staffan de Mistura told reporters in Geneva he would be sending out invitations tomorrow for the talks.
No preconditions, at least to start the talks and while the talks start. The rest is open. It's going to be uphill. They are not in an agreement yet, but we are all feeling that what has been happening in the past and what also the region and the main stakeholders feel, the time has come to at least try hard to produce an outcome.
The sides will not talk directly to each other to begin with, but negotiators will move between them. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton says an independent presidential run by former billionaire New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg won't be necessary. Clinton spoke on NBC's Meet the Press after reports that Bloomberg is taking some early steps toward launching a potential independent campaign for president.
He's a good friend of mine, and I'm going to do the best I can to make sure that I get the nomination, and we'll go from there.
So you're not worried about him getting in?
Well, the way I read what he said is if I didn't get the nomination, he might consider it. Well, I'm going to relieve him of that and get the nomination so he doesn't have to.
Sources close to Bloomberg said he would consider running if the general election looked like it would be a contest between Democrat Bernie Sanders and Republicans Donald Trump or Ted Cruz. Sanders said that would be fine with him.
If Donald Trump wins and Mr. Bloomberg gets in, you're going to have two multi-billionaires running for president of the United States against me. And I think the American people do not want to see our nation move toward an oligarchy where billionaires control the political process. I think we'll win that election.
Bloomberg reportedly has set a March deadline to make a decision. Donald Trump said he's so confident about the loyalty of his supporters that he predicted they'd stick with him even if he shot someone.
The people, my people are so smart. And you know what else they say about my people? The polls. They say, I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible. No, they say, Trump, we love you too, man.
A figure from the Republican establishment, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, introduced Trump at a rally 9 days before the Iowa caucuses opened voting in the 2016 campaign. Detroit school teachers plan to protest outside of a court where a judge was to hear arguments in a case that could force the teachers to stop staging sick outs. The teacher sick outs have repeatedly forced the district to close schools during the past 2 weeks. A judge was to hold a hearing today on the district's bid to stop the absences. Detroit teacher and activist Steve Kahn said the governor and the school district's emergency manager should be put on trial, not the teachers. Teachers have protested hazardous conditions in the schools, including black mold and rats, crumbling buildings, pay and class size, as well as the governor's plan to overhaul the district. The emergency manager for the Detroit schools, Darnell Early, is the same person who the governor had appointed emergency manager of Flint. In that position, Early ordered the disastrous switch from Detroit's water system to the Flint River, leading to lead poisoning in Flint children. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. There are some moves now on solitary confinement. President Barack Obama announced some changes in solitary confinement in relation to juveniles. And meanwhile, there is a case, a federal judge will be holding a hearing on whether to grant a final approval of a case which will end indeterminate solitary confinement throughout California prisons. Let's go to a clip now hearing the president, what the president had to say last year at the speech he gave to the NAACP National Convention that was held in Philadelphia.
The social science shows that an environment like that is often more likely to make inmates more alienated, more hostile, potentially more violent. Do we really think it makes sense to lock so many people alone in tiny cells for 23 hours a day, for months, sometimes for years at a time? That is not going to make us safer. That's not going to make us stronger. And if those individuals are ultimately released, how are they ever going to adapt? It's not smart. Our prisons should be a place where we can train people for skills that can help them find a job, not train them to become more hardened criminals.
The Washington Post, Cleveland.com, and other news outlets are reporting that President Obama announced yesterday that he's banning solitary confinement for juveniles in solitary federal prisons. He also said that he's going to ban solitary confinement as a response to low-level infractions along demand of prisoners, and also increase the amount of time prisoners in solitary confinement can spend outside of their cells, and expanding treatment for the mentally ill. Right now, prisoners in solitary are held inside their cells 23 hours a day if they get out at all. The changes will affect about 10,000 prisoners. Okay, this is, although only 13 juveniles were placed in solitary in federal facilities between September 2014 and September 2015. And President Obama asked the Department of Justice last summer to review the overuse of solitary confinement. For our listeners in California and indeed across the nation, they might recall the huge California prisoner hunger strike that took place a few years ago. And that began 30,000 strong, the largest hunger strike ever in U.S. history, either of prisoners or anyone else. And there's been a huge push on the part of prisoner rights advocates on the outside, but prisoners themselves on the inside against solitary confinement. We have been following this story of prisoners organizing against this, against solitary confinement, which many see as a form of torture. And now there is a case that we're going to be speaking with Rachel Maripol. Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Maripol is a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where she works on prisoners' rights, Muslim profiling, criminalization of dissent, and First Amendment issues. She is a lead counsel on a class action lawsuit challenging long-term solitary confinement in California's Pelican Bay Prison and represents federal prisoners held in the Bureau of Prisons Restrictive Communication Management Units. She is got her law degree from NYU, New York University, and she's co-edited and written two editions of the Jailhouse Lawyer's Handbook, a do-it-yourself litigation manual for prisoners distributed free by CCR and the National Lawyers Guild. So, Rachel, we're glad to have you. First, tell us your response to President Obama's announcement.
Well, this certainly is an exciting time for those of us who've been organizing against solitary confinement. The president's announcement is really so welcome and so long overdue. I'm very excited to read through the Department of Justice report, which he released yesterday, which includes, you know, voluminous recommendations to really overhaul the way the federal prison system uses solitary confinement. So, of course, you mentioned some of those changes. And I think, you know, along with the ones you mentioned, it's going to be incredibly important to see the federal system limit determinate terms in solitary confinement. So, of course, so many individuals languish in solitary confinement for years on end because they have been found guilty of prison rule violations. And the rule violations result in these incredibly long terms that do no good to anyone, that, you know, in fact, the opposite. We know have a devastating impact on prisoners' mental health, physical health, well-being, and their ability to sort of re-enter society. So the president is recommending that first offenses across the federal system be limited to a 60-day shoe term, a 60-day term in solitary. And to me, that seems like an incredible development.
Yeah, even though, according to a UN official, 15 days in solitary confinement is considered, torture, basically. And we know that prisoner organizations, prisoner rights organizations by formerly incarcerated people like All of Us or None have been so much at the forefront of pressing on these issues. And also the president made an announcement around Ban the Box, which is that box formerly incarcerated people have to check off when they're applying for a job and puts them at a disadvantage. And of course, this would only limit it for federal jobs that I think the president has the capacity to rule on. So a lot of movement there from the grassroots, from formerly incarcerated people and from prisoners themselves. So tell us also about this case, Ashker versus Brown.
Sure. Well, I'm glad that you introduced the segment by talking about the hunger strikes across California over the last 5 years or so, because that's really the beginning of this story. And I think, you know, I think the hunger strikes are, it's important to understand that, you know, if I could identify one motivating factor that has led us to where we are now, that has led us to where we are in our challenge to solitary confinement in California, that has led us to where we are, where the President of the United States has taken such a strong stand against solitary, it's about the prisoners organizing themselves. These hunger strikes drew national and international attention to the plight of individuals in solitary confinement. And one of the things they did was garnered the Center for Constitutional Rights' attention to what was happening in solitary confinement. So starting in 2012, we joined with prisoners who were organizing around this issue and local California lawyers, including Legal Services for Prisoners with Children and California Prison Focus, to bring a class action challenging prolonged solitary confinement in Pelican Bay Prison. Now, we litigated that case very successfully for several years, and just this past fall, in September, came to a settlement with the California Department of Corrections, which completely overhauls the way that California uses solitary confinement, specifically for individuals it accuses of being affiliated with prison gangs. So the settlement transforms California's system from a status-based system, where an individual who's alleged to be a gang affiliate will spend years in solitary confinement, regardless of whether he's ever violated a prison rule or acted violently in prison, to a system where only behavior, only proven serious misconduct, results in a solitary confinement term. Today, we'll be in court this afternoon seeking final approval of that settlement.
Right. So what do you have any idea? I mean, this is going to be huge. And I must say, I totally agree with you about the impact of that prisoner hunger strike. We covered it, I think, daily as it was going on. And, you know, also so many family members who were out there really keeping that hunger strike front and center. But also the fact that the prisoners prior to the hunger strike had signed an agreement to end racial hostilities. And it meant that then prisoners, black prisoners, Native American, white prisoners, Latino prisoners were able to come together. And it really helped to make the hunger strike possible. And they now have asked those of us out in the community to work on ending racial hostilities and also to end the retaliation against those who participated in that hunger strike. But tell us, Rachel, about how many people do you think would be impacted? I mean, what would this settlement actually mean?
So the settlement requires that California, within a year of preliminary approval, so by next fall, review every single prisoner in solitary confinement across the state who is there because of gang association. That's thousands of individuals across the state.
Yeah.
So in undertaking that review, CDCR will be looking to see if those individuals have a serious rule violation, what they call a SHU-eligible offense, so an offense that can send you to solitary on its own, regardless of gang validation. And if individuals have an offense of that type within the last 2 years, they will enter a step-down program to step down out of solitary confinement. If they have no serious rule violation within the last 2 years, which is the vast majority of the individuals who will be reviewed, they will be released to the general population. These reviews are happening right now. Hundreds of them have already occurred, and hundreds of prisoners have already been transferred out to general population. Moving forward, prisoners will only be placed in solitary if they are found guilty of one of a series of enumerated rule violations. So no longer will California place prisoners in solitary simply based on alleged association. The settlement also places a cap, an across-the-board cap, on solitary confinement at Pelican Bay, recognizing that the conditions at that prison are unreasonably harsh and that individuals should not spend more than 5 years in solitary confinement at that facility. Of course, we hope that solitary stays will be significantly shorter than that now that we've moved to this new program. The settlement also sets up a new unit called the Restricted Custody General Population Unit, where prisoners who do continually violate prison rules but have been in solitary confinement for over 10 years will be given the opportunity to move into a less restrictive setting. So it's high security, but it allows for some social interaction to begin the attempt of preparing these prisoners for a general population setting.
Right. Well, a lot going on there. And what are the chances? I mean, are you hopeful then of the result of the hearing today?
Oh, yes. We are very optimistic. When the judge granted preliminary approval of the settlement back in October, Judge Wilkin indicated that, you know, she thought this was this looked like a great settlement. Really, you know, what's happened over the last few months is that after preliminary approval, all the prisoners who will be affected by the settlement need to receive notice of its terms and an opportunity to object. And that's, of course, a matter of due process. So they have now had that opportunity. And, you know, out of the thousands of prisoners affected by this settlement, only a handful have written to the court to object to it and have objected, you know, not really on the basis that any of the settlement's terms are particularly unfair, but rather that it doesn't go far enough. And of course, that's true. It doesn't fix everything that's wrong with California's prison system. It fixes a lot, but there is more work to be done. And we, of course, are devoted to working with the prisoners and their families to continue that struggle. One of the things that I think is very important about the settlement is that it provides the prisoners and prisoners' counsel with the right to monitor the settlement for at least 2 years and potentially longer.
Yeah.
So that means that we are getting information about, you know, all of the reviews, conditions in solitary, conditions in the solitary confinement units across the state, and what's being done to ensure that this is being implemented fully and fairly.
Right. Well, Rachel Maripol, thank you so much. And I must say that this is such an example of leadership for justice coming from people behind bars. I mean, I have been so inspired by the fact that they were able to do a hunger strike across racial lines, across all prisons in California, starting out 30,000 strong, and really the kind of direction that they're giving to movements outside of prisons for peace and justice. Is coming from prisoner rights activists and formerly incarcerated people, and showing that you can fight, well, in this case, not City Hall, but the prison system, and knowing that we're up against the powerful prison guards union in California. So this is just an incredible progress here. And thank you for joining us, and thank you for your work. Thank you, Rachel.
Oh, thank you. It's absolutely inspirational to have been able to take direction from the prisoners in this work.
Absolutely. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are now going to turn our attention to our international segment for today, an update with what is happening in Syria. For Sojourner Truth listeners, you know, we have been following this story for quite some time, and we know that they are, it seems, several proxy wars going on in Syria. I mean, there is the Saudi Arabia, the Saudis backing a lot of the so-named rebels against the Assad government. We know that the peace movement that began as part in Syria as part of the Arab Spring that also opposed the Assad government but was against violence, they were very, very quickly sidelined by armed rebels, several of whom are from groups that are considered quote-unquote jihadists, like the al-Nusra Front and then later on IS. The U.S. policy in there, some say it's confused, but actually I'm not quite sure that it's so confused. I mean, the U.S. has long time been an ally of the Saudi Arabia that has its own interests and have been backing the armed rebels there. And also they've been bombing Yemen, by the way, with including cluster bombs that they got from the United States. And the United States also just sold a few billion dollars, I think, of new arms to the Saudis. And the other person involved, the other government involved in this proxy war, of course, is Russia. And their role, they are supporting the Assad government. And then, of course, the split between Iran and the Saudis all play a role in this. So it's been a very, very complicated situation. And now this morning, the Islamic State has bombed Homs, a Syria city that was controlled by the Assad government. The reports, latest reports are at least 24 people killed, 17 still in hospital, one of whom is in critical condition. There were two explosions, a car bomb and second, a suicide bomber. Let us go now to a clip clip from CNN, because the other piece that I should mention is that the last month the UN adopted a so-named peace plan. This is after 5 years of bloodshed that has left a quarter of a million people killed, 4.5 million are refugees, another 8 million that have been internally displaced. And then following that resolution, the Saudis held a meeting in Riyadh of the opposition of governments, Arab governments that are their allies. And many people thought that this meeting arranged by the Saudis was an attempt to really undermine the peace plan and to refocus the debate really on regime change, on removing Assad. So now the peace talks have now been delayed until Friday, we're told Friday, because there is some argument about who actually represents the opposition in Syria. Let's go to a CNN clip now.
Al-Qaeda-linked fighters claim to have seized American weapons. Opposition activists say al-Nusra Front has taken over some key towns in Idlib province. You see them there on the map. You see that area, I should say, outlined on the map. And they say that they have taken some heavy weaponry from an arms depot in Khan Subul. One activist says the fighters have seized about 70% of the territory once held by more moderate rebels. Those are the rebels the U.S. wants to support, wants to train, wants to arm. Are they surrendering to an al-Qaeda group? Our Nick Payne Walsh is live in Gaziantep, Turkey, with more on this. Nick, what's going on there in Idlib? It looks like the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda-linked group, is making some huge gains.
Well, certainly Nusra have always been the big military player around Idlib, but they sort of tolerated in their midst groups like the Hazm movement and the Syrian Revolutionary Front, more moderate groups, less militarily impressive, it's fair to say, but in many ways backed by the United States. I should say the US has never publicly said they've been supplying weapons to these groups, but it's widely said amongst rebel ranks that that is the case, or at least they're supplied through Arab ally proxies. So a complex picture in terms of those weapons, and there's no confirmation from the US that they have fallen into Nusra hands, and in fact Nusra themselves don't supply a video convincingly to that effect at all. But there has been a substantial change in territory hands in that area around Idlib. One analyst saying about 70% of the areas that the Hazm movement and Syrian Revolutionary Front used to hold in the Idlib suburbs have been taken now by Nusra. Why is this happening? Well, there are some suggestions Nusra is seeking to homogenize that area, remove any potential opponents, or at least remind everyone who's boss. There are said still potentially to be talks happening between these moderates and Nusra. It doesn't sound like it's over yet, but some observers are also pointing to the fact that simply Nusra wants to stamp its mark on this territory, have broader control, and certainly present itself as a much more authoritative movement, given the rise of ISIS in the past few months or so. Hala?
Well, this, if it does indeed, if it is indeed the case that Nusra rebels are taking over territory, potentially even getting their hands on weapons once controlled by more moderate rebels, this has to complicate the calculus for countries like the United States in that part of Syria, right?
Well, certainly. I mean, if you look at U.S. policy, yes, what little U.S. policy there has been in Syria has been dependent on these moderate rebel groups being vetted, being equipped, possibly being armed by allies or down the line. But look at the broader Syrian battlefield. Frankly, they've represented a very small amount of those doing the actual fighting. Nusra, much more on the front lines. Many, I think, would say objectively more effective against regime targets, too. So does it massively change the equation on the battlefield? Probably not. Does it massively undermine U.S. policy? If it is the case, they're losing territory very fast. Yes.
All right. There you go, from CNN. And this is from a report that says Syria's al-Nusra more dangerous than ISIS. Here to help us understand all of this, I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Robert Parry. He is an award-winning investigative journalist, and he is the editor of ConsortiumNews.com. He's been writing quite a lot about the region. Robert Parry, welcome back.
Thanks, Margaret. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so there you go. I mean, even CNN now is talking about the problems with some of the so-named rebels in Syria, pointing out al-Nusra. And it also, with these peace talks, it remains unclear actually who will be at the table. Apparently, some announcement of the final list has not yet been made. So, and then there's, of course, the bombing of homes that happened just a little bit ago. So your take on what is happening now? Why? What are some of the problems with the peace talks? And do you think that they're kind of for show, or do you think anything substantive could come out of it, Robert Parry?
Well, theoretically, something substantive could come out of it. There, the outlines for how to achieve a settlement, at least a political settlement, have been there for some time. The big issue has been that the United States and its Sunni allies in the region are demanding that that President Assad must go, that he will not even be allowed to take part in elections that would be part of this peace process. The position of the Russians has been essentially to leave the choice up to the Syrian people to have, once there's some kind of relative ceasefire, once there's some security, to go ahead with the elections and let people run as they wish and win or lose as the Syrian people decide. That would not exclude Assad from putting his name in for running for president again. The Americans have taken this sort of a mixed position. While Secretary of State Kerry has suggested that it really should be up to the Syrian people to decide their leadership, which may strike some as a no-brainer, some of the more hardline interventionists inside the Obama administration, people like UN Ambassador Samantha Power and others at the State Department, supposedly under Kerry, have been trying to continue this idea that Assad must be barred from running in the election. In other words, that democracy should not be the solution to the situation in Syria, that regime change should still be imposed from the outside. So that's remained a core problem. The other key problems are that the United States has been supplying weaponry, including some sophisticated weaponry, to some of the more extreme groups, like Ahrar al-Sham. That's a group that fights side by side with al-Qaeda's Nusra Front, yet has been given TOW missiles with U.S. approval by the Saudis and others. So you have very sophisticated American weaponry in the hands of some of these rebels because the Obama administration has sort of moved back and forth as to whether it should be backing the more effective, militarily effective groups. As CNN pointed out, the most effective groups have been these jihadist groups. These are fairly extreme groups, either that they are part of al-Qaeda's network or they're allied with it. Then you also have the Islamic State, which was a spinoff from al-Qaeda, operating somewhat in a somewhat different territory. But Turkey has failed, I think refused may even be the better word, to close off its border and has continued to allow fighters and weapons and money and oil to cross back and forth between ISIS territory in Syria and Turkey. So you have American allies in the region really not cooperating with what was probably the most important step, which would be to cut off these extreme groups from their financial and military support pouring in from across these borders. So what you do have a very mixed up situation, and some of it is reflected in the fact that the Saudis are putting together who the opposition should be at these peace talks, and the Saudis have been somewhat covertly, somewhat overtly involved in supporting some of the most extreme radical groups in the area, and therefore they kind of want these jihadist groups, perhaps not al-Qaeda per se, certainly not the Islamic State per se, but some of the groups that have fought alongside these other extremists to be represented and, in fact, even lead the opposition talks that are supposed to take place in Geneva. So you have, if that's the case, and if the demands continue that Assad must step down, then those talks probably will not go very far like previous ones haven't. But if realism takes over, and the realism is really being forced not just because of the bloodshed in Syria and the chaos in the Middle East, but this chaos is now spreading to Europe, where the European Union is on the verge of breaking apart in many ways, with the countries there rebelling against the idea of resettling Syrian and other Middle Eastern refugees in their countries. So we're seeing this neocon agenda of regime change across the Middle East now become almost a case of something close to regime change in Europe. So with that as sort of the grave danger hovering over all that whole section of the world, there is new pressure to get realistic, get some kind of a peace deal, and let the Syrian people eventually sort it out themselves rather than have all these outside parties grabbing at things and telling them what to do.
Yeah, I mean, that the your point is well taken in terms of a regime change, because it just seemed all along that was really the bottom line. I mean, no matter for the U.S. and the Saudis and their allies, how many Syrian lives are lost. And, you know, you see the Syrian families. I mean, so many, a quarter of a million people killed. You know that most of them are civilians. And just if and the peace movement, the early peace movement, which I remember and spoke to some of them. We interviewed some of them around the period of the Arab Spring when protests first began in Syria, and they were very quickly sidelined. But this whole thing of regime change, you know, as a policy of the U.S., we've seen it. It's playing out right now where they're attempting to force an election on the people of Haiti, a selection, and the people have refused it. And the selection that was supposed to happen on Sunday was actually stopped because of the level of mass protests on the street. But for a lot of people looking at this, the whole regime change aspect of it against in replacing Assad, but also regime change in relation to Putin and Russia, gets lost in all of this. And I remember when we spoke, we interviewed you and some other people around the Ukraine, and it was evident, too, that there is this constant picking away against Putin. Not to say that, you know, people shouldn't be protesting against Putin's policies, but for outside forces like the U.S. and NATO interested in regime change there as well. What's your view on this, Robert Parry?
Well, we've seen this idea of regime change seize control of official Washington. You can trace it back, I suppose, into even the Cold War period, but it certainly became a major element by the mid-90s with the neoconservatives, who were increasingly influential at that time, deciding that what they were going to do, instead of negotiating with the Palestinians regarding Israel's future, they were simply going to throw out the Oslo Accords, which, of course, were signed in 1995, and go for a series of regime changes, get rid of the troubling countries around Israel as a way then to sort of create a fait accompli that if the Palestinians had no more support and if Hezbollah could be isolated in Lebanon, then the thinking was the Israelis could pretty much dictate the outcome. So that became the neocon goal, and they listed them. Iraq was going to be probably first. Syria was, you know, following on. Iran, and as these policies actually began to be implemented last decade with the invasion of Iraq, we started seeing this how unrealistic and dangerous these policies were. The destruction of Iraq, the horrible bloodshed and the chaos that was created around it. It didn't go as neatly as the neocons had planned in their think tanks and on their op-ed pages. It was a mess, and it created all this increasing instability. Now, because the neocons were really never punished for that, they were never driven out of Washington. They remained very influential and powerful, and they had their allies, these so-called liberal interventionists, on the Democratic side. People who, many of whom, supported the Iraq War, they signed on because it sounded like the smart political play at the time, and so you had this combination within both the Republican and Democratic parties of the most influential forces being in favor of more and more regime change, Syria was always expected to be on the list. The Assad had to go. The hope was to also then bomb Iran, if you remember,
yep,
and get regime change there. And then we've seen also the liberal interventionists and the neocons do regime change in Libya, another country that is now in chaos, another failed state. And we've seen the consequences of all this, with not just the horrible bloodshed that has and the spreading of this Islamic extremism, but we're seeing the flood of refugees pouring into Europe. These heartbreaking images of people,
yeah,
fleeing in small boats and, you know, children drowning, and now we're seeing the consequences in Europe as the whole European experiment, which was one of the great accomplishments after World War II to bring this very bloody continent together as more of a whole. We're seeing that now shaking and possibly coming apart. People like Merkel, for instance, Chancellor Merkel of Germany, is now under extreme political pressure. She may not survive the resistance to the having these million refugees settled,
yeah,
in Europe. So what we're seeing is the neocons had this idea of regime change, and they keep spreading it. They did it with Ukraine and that's become another failed state. And they have dreams even of doing regime change in Moscow, possibly the most dangerous idea of all, because as much as people may dislike Putin, he's actually a rational player. The real danger in having a regime change in Moscow is that as much as the neocons might think they can appoint some new Yeltsin character who will do whatever they tell them, the more likely consequence is you will get an extreme nationalist,
yeah,
who might actually decide to start pushing nuclear buttons. So there has to be sort of an imposition, a reimposition of more realistic policies. But we're seeing that as a politically difficult thing in Washington, because the neoconservatives and the liberal interventionists remain the dominant forces. They are now the establishment,
yeah,
when it comes to American foreign policy.
Yeah, well, thank you for breaking that down. So true. A lot more to discuss there. And of course, Robert Parry, we'll have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break. And coming up, we get an update on the Porter Ranch gas leak, referred to as the largest environmental disaster in the United States since the BP oil spill in 2010. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Wake up, America. Open up your eyes and see. Ask yourself this question.
And that music is Wake Up America by Lattie Moore. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And we would also like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners. You can check us out at our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And we would like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners in the Middle East. We'd like to welcome them and thank them for listening. Our website also has our back shows, the archives. So if you've missed any Sojourner Truth shows, you can go to our website and get them there. And also, please remember to like and friend us on Facebook. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. You could also check out our show there and share it with others as well. We are now going to have our weekly Earth Minute, and then we could go on for an update on the Porter Ranch gas leak.
Following the UN climate talks in Paris last December, a new study has been released titled Extreme Carbon Inequality, which debunks the idea that developing countries like India and China are most responsible for climate emissions. The study points out that the richest 1% of the global population contributes 175 times as much to climate change as the poorest 10%. And even though the richest 10% of the U.S. population emits three times as much carbon as the 600 million poorest Chinese, U.S. negotiators in Paris blocked any deal that put too much blame for climate change on the United States. But not only did the U.S. and its allies reject responsibility for climate change, they further blocked any agreement to help compensate developing countries, like the sinking small islands of the Pacific, for example, for loss and damage caused by climate change. Meanwhile, the impacts of climate change are conservatively estimated to push another 100 million people into poverty by 2030. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
All righty, we are now going to turn our attention to the Porter Ranch gas leak on October 23rd. 3rd, 2015, within the Porter Ranch area of Los Angeles County, a noxious gas blowout was detected by Southern California Gas Company, caused by damage to a well casing on one of the wells some 500 feet below the surface. Now, this leak is the largest of its kind, and some are calling it the worst environmental disaster since BP's Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010. Thousands of residents have had to be evacuated. Animals are also being impacted, and it took quite a while before the governor of California, Jerry Brown, proclaimed a state of emergency in LA County. That was not until January the 6th. And then yesterday, January 25th, the Southern California Gas Company announced that the Aliso Canyon Natural Gas Storage Facility has entered into its fifth and final phase to cap the leaking well, with a final completion date in late February. Well, it all remains to be seen. And how widespread this is in terms of impacting residents of Southern California, well, who knows if we'll ever find that out. Let us go now to a clip from Channel 7 about a recent community meeting that took place over this past weekend.
To that ongoing gas leak in Porter Ranch, today frustrated residents attended a meeting to demand the closure of the plant in the middle of it all. Many left the building disappointed.
We're not safe. We're not healthy. Shut it all down, please. Thank you.
Residents making their voices heard as the South Coast Air Quality Management District Hearing Board rules on a nuisance abatement order against SoCalGas for the massive gas leak in Porter Ranch.
We are literally being gassed to death.
The AQMD ordering the utility company to permanently close and seal the leaking well, which SoCalGas has already said it will do. The board also ordering the company to fund a health study for residents in the affected area and to develop an enhanced leak detection system for all the wells at the facility. But the board stopped short of calling for the entire plant to be shut down.
Total frustration and anger. The AQMD could have used their full authority to shut this facility down, at least temporarily, and they refused to do that. They didn't give us any reason why.
SoCalGas stands ready to implement this nuisance abatement order now that it's been finalized.
Angry residents also ready to move forward with their fight to close the facility. They say the natural gas leak is causing a list of health problems for themselves and their pets, and fear the long-term health impacts, and say the AQMD didn't go far enough.
It was temporary anyway. Pretty much everything on there expires in January of next year. But we're moving for the permanent shutdown.
SoCalGas says they should have the leak sealed off by late February, if not sooner. Residents say this never should have happened in the first place.
All right, there you go. That was from a meeting that took place this past weekend. I'd like to welcome in studio Alexandra Neji. She is the Southern California organizer at the Los Angeles branch of Food and Water Watch. Alexandra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Alexandra, one question in my mind is, how widespread is the impact of this? And I worry that we might never know. I hear people from as far away as the east side of Los Angeles complaining of symptoms, these kind of weird symptoms a lot going around. And we know, of course, people in the immediate area are going to be the ones most impacted. Do you know if any methodology has been set up to study the health impacts on people as well as pets?
Not quite yet. What we have seen, the UC Davis pilot that has been going around and taking methane readings, very short-term kind of methane readings, have found that as far down as Orange County, we're seeing elevated levels of methane as a direct result of this gas leak. So looking at the health impacts, we know just from conversation that people are getting sick all over the San Fernando Valley. You're saying east side of LA. I think it's all warranted, but the problem is that we're only doing limited air monitoring in and around the areas of Porto Ranch, even though folks in Granada Hills and Chatsworth and Northridge and communities surrounding that area are within the 5-mile relocation zone at this point. We're just not doing full comprehensive air monitoring across all the areas where this could be a problem. And on top of that, the health study that we just got is going to be paid for by the gas company, administered, we don't know when. And so really looking at that air data and matching it up with people's symptoms is going to be a big part of the conversation. We just don't know until that kind of a study would come out.
Yeah, and I'm wondering also, just in terms of the gas company and accountability here, I do want to talk a little bit about the difference between, well, they're talking about capping the well and residents just want the thing shut down. But, you know, Southern California Gas Company and changed the name to Sempra, they moved to privatization of the services to residents in Southern California that use the gas. You know, you used to be able to call, you know, gas is very dangerous. You used to be able to call the gas company. They would send out a union member to take care of the problem. And now you got to call a private company, you got to pay. I'm wondering how much privatization has impacted Southern California really keeping up with perhaps problems in these wells, and I'm wondering if that whole issue of privatization has emerged and as a topic in all of this.
Only barely. I mean, when you're talking about a for-profit utility as opposed to LADWP, which is the largest public utility in the country, you definitely see the way they do business is very different. They promote their bottom line. They want the ratepayers and the taxpayers to pay for everything and just reap profit from us and from giving them us a service. And that's what's been the problem. They've known about this facility and the problems with it for a very long time, the aging infrastructure, the deteriorating wells, all of this they've acknowledged. And instead of stockpiling, you know, their profits and putting aside a reserve fund to deal with these types of maintenance issues and, you know, basic repair and maintenance, they want ratepayers to pay for that. And so that has to go through a whole public process, right, where the Public Utilities Commission, who is working with the gas company and working to protect their interests and their bottom line, looks at how we can, you know, raise our rates to further promote natural gas, which is a huge issue. I mean, we've seen that our reliance on natural gas, our reliance on fossil fuels is a big problem. And when we have these major infrastructure pieces that are falling apart and deteriorating, we're not able to shut them down because the company doesn't want us to. That's a really big problem. So in the last Saturday, we saw the local air district made a decision not to shut the facility down, which they should have drained the facility completely. That's the only thing that's worked so far to mitigate the leak is to depressurize it. But they opted not to do that. And they instead said, let's just do more air monitoring. Let's do more health studies. So it's a total, you know, hands-off approach to the situation. And that's why we're really frustrated with Governor Brown. His executive order was very clear. Maximize the withdrawal. Find gas and electricity from other sources. But then you have the agencies below him kind of fighting over who has the jurisdiction to do what, you know, really misinterpreting what we think he did. And so he needs to step in and really take control and lead on this situation. People's lives are in danger. 12,000 people have relocated. So he can't be on the sidelines anymore. He needs to get involved.
Yeah, so if they do manage to cap the well, I know there was some talk for a while of burning it off, and then they were worried that the whole thing was just going to explode, right? If they do manage to cap it, I mean, do you think your Food and Water Watch and some of the other community-based organizations, are they going to continue to press for shutting it down, or do you think that that's pretty much going to end that initiative?
Well, we're hoping for a temporary shutdown, but we also are working towards a permanent shutdown of this facility. That's not going to stop. These residents are never going to feel safe in their homes again. There's a huge question of if the leak is capped, how then do we move back into a contaminated area? What are the next processes there? How do we continue to hold the gas company accountable? There's just no such thing as a safe well. There's no such thing as a safe natural gas field or a clean, non-polluting fossil fuel system. So this needs to be shut down. If these facilities are not compatible with our communities, period. And so it needs to be shut down permanently.
Right. And Alexandria, I mean, putting this in the big picture here, I mean, you talked about the gas company and their bottom line basically being profit. And I mean, if this is an example of profits before people, I don't know what is. Porter Ranch is known as a more affluent community. I spoke with somebody from Food and Water Watch about the horror that's going on in Flint, Michigan, with the poisoning of the water there, mainly a black, you know, and poverty-stricken town. But here you have people kind of a higher income bracket having to face that their lives are not of value either when it comes to profit.
Right. Right, yeah. Right. And I think that's been a really hard wake-up call for people in this community who maybe felt that the government was looking out for them or felt that, you know, they could trust the gas company. And that's just been flipped upside down 100%. And then we've been working to educate the community on the other struggles happening across Los Angeles and South LA. For example, the oil drilling that's been happening right next to people's homes, and they've been getting sick for years. They're not getting relocated. And so there's a really big effort right now to sort of use this as
a double standard there as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, our goal is to really educate Porter Ranch and the surrounding community about how this is a climate injustice issue, environmental injustice across the board, and how, you know, their privilege, their community and the situation that they're in allows them sort of a leg up when it comes to fighting this and allows them a better media market and these types of things, and understanding how they can leverage that to support the struggles in South LA. And so those are the conversations that we're interested in having and that folks are very open and receptive to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my view and others have said that if black lives don't matter, then the lives of nobody else really matters.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so starting from the bottom up. So really looking at that and contrasting what has gone on in South L.A., where people weren't getting relocated with Porter Ranch. And of course, people should be relocated. I don't see that as a privilege, but as a right.
Absolutely.
OK, we should all have the same rights. Just finally, for people who want to get involved in your campaign and support your efforts, what should they do?
You can go to foodandwaterwatch.org. We have Facebook and Twitter. And then shout out to safeporterranch.com. And then if you're interested in the struggles in South L.A., Standing Together Against Neighborhood Drilling Los Angeles.
Okay, definitely. Thank you so much. Thank you, Alexandra.
Thank you very much.
We are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our long-term intern, Sherelle Withers, assistant producer, Jose Benavides. I'd like to thank Stephanie Case with her help with today's show. And of course, our engineer, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson. You can follow us on Twitter. Look for So True Radio and become our Facebook friend. Look for Sojourner Truth Radio. And check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Sorry about that. That's 1-800-735-0230. Go online to PacificaRadioArchives.org. Stay tuned for Uprising. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. America.